This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. The first Tuesday in November is Election Day, and with all due respect for the gubernatorial and mayoral contest being decided today, well, next year, 2004, is a presidential election year. Along with the presidency, both houses of Congress and many more state houses and legislatures are all up for grabs. And yes, a whole year seems like a long time, but the Iowa caucuses are just 10 weeks away. New Hampshire follows a week after that, and then the primaries come thick and fast. At least in broad outlines, two major issues have emerged this year, Iraq and the economy, and even 12 months out, it sometimes feels as if the nine Democratic presidential candidates have already been running forever. This hour, a preview of the coming year in politics. We'll check in on Iowa and New Hampshire, find out what the Republicans are up to while the Democrats decide, ask how the Internet is changing things, and we'll give you the winter book odds on House and Senate elections. And later, why the $87 billion Iraq spending bill was passed with just five senators' voice votes. Join the conversation. When do you start paying attention to electoral politics? Are you more interested in issues or character? A year away, are you paying attention to the upcoming elections? And who are your favorites? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is TOTN@NPR.org. And we have an email challenge for you this hour. Many voters let buttons do the talking for them, from the smiling Jimmy Carter peanut to the three-fingered W. Buttons are a fun feature of any election cycle. What would you suggest to this year's candidates as a possible campaign button? The email address is TOTN@NPR.org. And joining us here now in Studio 3A for a guided political tour is NPR's political editor, Ken Rudin. And welcome to the show.
Neil, this is the best show you've ever done in the history of NPR.
That's not going to fit on a button.
Okay.
Help us with the lay of the land, Ken. How close? 10 weeks to Iowa.
Well, what's so remarkable about this is that even though it's only 10 weeks to Iowa, and then, as you say, 8 days later to New Hampshire, this race could be over shortly afterwards. Nobody, or outside of Iowa and New Hampshire, few voters, and the polls show this, few voters are paying attention. And yet we may have a Democratic nominee by the middle of February, the March 2nd, the latest, because all these early primaries have been bunched so close together that whatever momentum comes out of Iowa and New Hampshire, and we could talk about whether momentum will come out of Iowa and New Hampshire, but whatever comes out of the early primaries, the voters seem to go along with that, and it's over. It's been the history of, once they've moved up the primaries from, you know, they used to be spread out mm-hmm. until June, now it's all over in early March. We'll have a nominee certainly before then.
Well, we're going to talk about issues. We're going to be talking about money. We're going to be talking about advertising and all the other correlated issues. But in the Democratic presidential campaign, this compressed schedule or front-loaded schedule, as you're describing, that's going to be a decisive factor, clearly. Why did this happen? Is this just every state trying to get closer to the beginning so that they seem more important, or was this a conscious political decision?
No, I think it's the former. Which it's exactly this. The states like California historically used to have a June primary. Now, in the old days, back in 1968, 72, when they were only about 10 or 12 primaries and spread out, California was the big enchilada. And, of course, we all remember Bobby Kennedy and Jim McCarthy in 68. At least I remember that. but of course, now with Iowa and New Hampshire pumped up and all the other states moving up closer and closer, the bigger states said, well, wait, nobody's going to wait for June for this. We, you know, our voices will be meaningless, so they'll move up too. And what happens is that it just all at once, and the candidates, first of all, the candidates, if you don't have the money to compete in 50 primaries in the course of 5 weeks, you're out of it. And that's why everybody talks about all the money that President Bush is raising. Of course, he's running unopposed in the primaries, but Howard Dean, all the money he's raising, he has to raise all this money because of this compressed schedule.
Now, some people argued that this was, in fact, a conscious decision by Terry McAuliffe, who's the head of the Democratic National Committee, to get a Democratic candidate decided early so that they can start then running against President Bush and not wait until, May or June before we know who the Democratic candidate's going to be.
There is that argument, but there's also the problem of buyer's remorse, and that you have all these primaries decided so early, you could have a Democratic nominee by early March. What about April, May, June, July, before the convention in Boston? What if Democrats say, well, I don't think we got the right guy or gal. By then, it's too late, of course.
Mm-hmm. In any case, that's going to be a major factor in all of this, as you mentioned, money raising. But the other thing that's been going on, and it does seem like it's been going on for quite a while now, are the Democratic presidential candidate debates. There's a CNN Rock the Vote debate, tonight in Faneuil Hall in Boston. There are more than these than there used to be?
Yes, there are, and there's also more Democratic candidates than there used to be. You'll have 9 Democrats. I mean, rarely have you had this many. You had a similar amount in 1976, but you didn't have this many primaries. I think the reason you have so many debates is, again, while few people are paying attention, it'll be over before you know it. So this gives the voters an opportunity to see, I mean, what is Dennis Kucinich like? What is Joe Lieberman and John Edwards and Dick Gephardt? What do they have to say? It's hard to read position papers. Not everybody goes on the internet to check out the candidacies and the candidate positions, although many do. And I think the best way to do it is watching these debates. But I can tell you that the viewership is really, really poor, very, very low numbers on these debates.
Clearly because their buttons aren't good enough.
That's one of the key reasons.
That's our email challenge this hour, asking our listeners for their favorite political buttons. As a connoisseur of buttons, as the scuttle button master yourself,
thank you very much.
What are your parameters? How do you decide? What makes a good button?
Well, you know, I started collecting in 1966, and in the old days, you know, now campaigns don't even make their own buttons. They have these outside jobbers, and you could buy them online, and that's how you get buttons, which is very remarkable. One of the candidates who's running for governor of California, Georgie Russell, on her website basically was just selling thongs and buttons. Now, for me, you know, obviously I'm more interested in the buttons, which lets you know what's wrong with me. But so obviously, today, what you need is obviously a catchy slogan. In the old days, I always thought that the best buttons were really the negative buttons because they're sharper. I mean, you know, negative buttons have a history going back to 1928 when Al Smith, the first Catholic, was running for president. Herbert Hoover put out a button and said, "We want a Christian in the White House," as if Al Smith was not a Christian. So the anti-buttons usually are the ones that really stand out in my mind.
I was going to ask you which has been your favorite so far this year, but I know the answer is all of them.
So. That's right. Not enough.
Joining us now from the Capitol is Senator Tom Harkin, a Democrat from Iowa who's serving his fourth term in the United States Senate. He was a presidential candidate himself when a little-known governor from Arkansas took the nomination. Senator Harkin, thanks very much for being with us today.
Yeah, Neil, it's nice to be with you. Whatever happened to that guy anyway?
I don't know. He's building a library somewhere, I think.
Snuck up behind me and, I don't know.
why does Iowa matter? Two of the candidates have announced that they're skipping Iowa this year. Is that a good idea or a bad one?
Well, I think in the case of General Clark, I think it is disastrous. I think it's going to doom his campaign. In the case of Senator Lieberman, quite frankly, I think probably in terms of what's happening to him in this campaign, I suppose it's probably all right for him. But in terms of Wesley Clark, I told him I thought this was just, I think this dooms this campaign.
Now, this is retail politics, a great deal like New Hampshire is, which comes up just a week later. Iowans, to really get to see these candidates, meet them in person?
Oh, they sure do, more than once. As a matter of fact, Howard Dean, for example, just finished visiting all 99 counties in the state of Iowa. Heck, I haven't done that in about 4 years.
I was going to ask you, when was the last time you did that?
that's been quite a while. So, I mean, yeah, they're out there. They're in living rooms. I was just there this weekend, and I looked at their schedules, and they're going. I mean, these candidates are out there for breakfast and coffees and lunch and a couple things in the afternoon, and couple things in the evening, so they're seeing a lot of people. It is retail.
And they can bring up a lot of issues that, well, I don't mean to, you know, be demeaning in any way, but maybe peculiar to the state of Iowa.
Well, I you know, every state has its local issues. Let's be frank about that, whether it's New York or California or whatever it might be. There are certain things that are unique to any state. But the broader issues that confront us as a country are also a part of the Iowa scene. Healthcare, prescription drugs for the elderly. We have, I think, what's the third or fourth largest proportion of elderly in our state, in the United States. Education. We've always prided ourselves in education in Iowa, and that's a big issue. And, of course, jobs in manufacturing. We've seen a lot of loss of jobs and manufacturing jobs in the state of Iowa. I think our unemployment rate now is hovering probably 30%, 35% higher than it was when George Bush took office. So these are issues in Iowa, but they're issues nationally also.
Our phone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. And let's be joined now by Mike, who's with us on the line from Detroit, Michigan.
Okay. Can you hear me all right?
Yes, you're on the air, Mike.
Oh, great. Well, you know, I have a question and a comment. And, you know, my comment is we had the debate here in Detroit last week.
Mm-hmm.
And all up leading up to the debates, the newspapers and all the media, you know, kept harping on nobody's interested. Well, in fact, we were all very interested. And if it wasn't for I had to listen to the debates on the radio. We had one station that carried them local. And then right after the debates, every media outlet said, what a shame. There was nothing said. I mean, it kind of like they camped down the exuberance that we all had out here to listen to the debates. And then, you know, every negative comment was amplified where Kucinich made a gaffe about how many people were murdered in Detroit and so on and so forth. It seems like that the media, and it's not here lately, it was all through the Clinton administration, the media, the only time it's going to say anything about the Democrats or the debate if there's something negative.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in spite of all the trouble that George Bush has been in lately, you know, it's just like the CIA thing there. You know, we heard that one or two days. Where's the coverage of that? If that was Bill Clinton who did that, oh, my God, they would have crucified him. If we would have gone to war based on a lie like that, we would have crucified Bill Clinton.
Why don't we stick?
The point I'm trying to make is that the media seems to be deliberately trying to tamp down the exuberance that we have out here. We're very excited about Howard Dean. Howard Dean is the man.
Mm-hmm.
I'm an activist, and I put up signs, carry people to the polls. That's the kind of guy I am. We are very, very hot on Dean. And it just seems like unless someone's got a negative comment to make about Howard Dean, we don't hear anything positive. And that's my point. And my question is, why, even NPR is doing this, why are the media outlets down on the Democrats? They have been for 8 years. It just seems like the establishment media is got nothing to say about Democrats unless it's negative. And Senator Harkin, I'm very happy that you're there.
Okay.
Okay.
Senator Harkin, from the viewpoint, thanks for the call, Mike. From the viewpoint of a campaign, can that seem to, you know, be a, you know, a mindset that takes effect, that everything you read about, you know, the debates and everything you read about your own campaign seems to be negative?
Well, yeah, I agree a lot with what Mike has to say, but that's sort of part of any kind of a process where you've got six or seven or eight or nine people running. I mean, I was involved in that, as you pointed out, in 1991, and it's really hard to break through in those early days. But maybe I take a little bit of issue with Mike. I think the media has done a fairly good job this year in terms of promoting. And at least making available to people all of the debates, for example, that the Democrats have had. Quite frankly, I happen to think that there are too many of these debates. Secondly, I had my Hear It from the Heartland presidential forums, and I had each candidate for an hour and a half, uninterrupted, in front of not a handpicked audience, just anybody in Iowa, to respond to any kind of questions. And they could get into depth as to what they felt about certain issues and they had follow-up questions. I thought those forums were excellent resources for people to see these candidates and really get more than just a soundbite answer from them. And quite frankly, if I might say so here on NPR, C-SPAN carried every one of them live, and then they carried them two or three times after that. And a lot of people around the country got to see our candidates in that kind of a setting. So I think it's been a pretty good coverage.
Senator Harkin, I know we promised to let you go. We have a caller, though, from Iowa who's on the line. Can you hang on for through the break with us?
Absolutely, Neil.
Thanks very much, Senator Harkin. We're going to be back after a short break. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're discussing the election process and how voters learn where the candidates stand on the issues. If you'd like to join our discussion, the phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, the email address TOTN at NPR.org. We do have an email challenge going on. Ken Rudin, NPR's political editor, is with us, and we've got two thus far. Dream with Dean comes in from Ray White, Muncie, in Indiana, and Support the West Wing from Clark04.com. That's not too bad.
Senator Harkin probably doesn't know this, but in 1991, I have a picture button of his. It says Tom Harkins with an S at the end. They spell his name wrong. So,
Senator Tom Harkin of Iowa is with us on the line, and we wanted to take one call.
I want you to know I've been called worse.
Chris is on the line with us from Ames, Iowa.
Yes, hello. First, I want to say, Senator Harkin, I am so delighted to be on the air at the same time with you because I want to ensure to you that in 2004, we will put you back in the chairmanship of those two terribly important committees. So we'll make it happen for you.
All right. Thanks, Chris.
You bet.
So, Chris, when you're there in Iowa, what do you see in terms of the campaign? Is it being taken as seriously this year as it has been in years past?
Oh, terribly much so. I'm an activist precinct chair in Ames, which is where Iowa State University is north of Des Moines. I will have the largest caucus in my county and perhaps one of the very largest in the state. I expect that I will have 200 to 250 people at my caucus. And we take it terribly seriously here. I have met all of the candidates except for the two who have decided not to campaign in the state. And I only missed Lieberman because I was sick that day. But I have met most of them at least three times, one of them at least six times, because he's been in the state, so blessed much. But it's a terribly important challenge for those of us who take our democracy seriously and who want to enfranchise as many of the voters as possible in the state to get them to the caucuses. First we get them registered as Democrats, and then we get them to the caucuses. So, yes, we take it terribly seriously here. And we would like to point out that one of the things that is repeatedly mischaracterized by the national media is that only 10% of the ultra-activist Democrats ever come to the caucus. That's completely, utterly wrong. In 1988, 25% of registered Democrats came out. In 2000, 22% came out. And we're aiming again for a 25% turnout of registered Democrats. And on a blisteringly cold January night of a three-day holiday weekend, that'll be pretty good. So
let me ask you a question, and I'm going to ask Senator Harkin to respond to it if he would. And that is it fair that Iowa, every turn around, goes first with its, you know, admittedly parochial interests and national interests as well, but isn't it time to rotate it to South Carolina or Nevada or Florida?
Well, Neil, I would like you to tell me, because you used the word peculiar earlier, what on earth you are referring to as parochial interest. There is not anything that I have heard any of the candidates talk about here that is not of interest in every single state of the union, in every community, whether it is a small town or cosmopolitan or suburban.
Well,
so please tell me, as an East Coast journalist, what you see as being the peculiar interest or the parochial interest of Iowa first, please.
Well, I think that there is an emphasis on agricultural issues
not.
In Iowa that
no,
is...
Not. Greater, not candidates, there is not.
That is greater than it is in other states.
No, there's not. We here...
And I wanted to get Senator Harkin, he's got to leave, so I wanted to get Senator Harkin a chance to respond to that same question.
Well, first, there is a genius, a real genius to the way we do things now with Iowa first and New Hampshire second. Iowa is a caucus state. As Chris has said, these are the people that really take their government seriously. They're willing to go out on that cold January night. They look at these candidates carefully. They assess their positions on issues. And it's just a kind of a good starting gate for the rest of the Democratic Party. And then you go to New Hampshire, which is a primary state, which is more akin to how you appear on television, sound bites, that type of thing. So I think that 1-2 kind of a opening gate is really kind of a genius. And quite frankly, every time that the National Democratic Party has sought to change it, no one can come up with anything better. And we've had votes. We had a vote, Senator Levin from Michigan pushed this very hard. He's been trying to change this for years. We finally had a vote in the entire Democratic National Committee about changing it, and they didn't want to change it. Even people from other states didn't want to change it. Because what happens is with Iowa and with New Hampshire, it permits someone with very little money, maybe not with a lot of name recognition, but who's a good campaigner, who's got good strong issues, has a good message, can provide leadership and organizational ability, they can make it to the presidency. If you have a regional primary, or if you start in a bigger state, which is just get on television, get the sound bites, well, that means only someone who has national prominence, who is famous, or who has a lot of money, can start in that situation. In Iowa, a Howard Dean, a Jimmy Carter can start, Dick Gephardt, others can start in Iowa and make it.
Senator Harkin, we've kept you longer than we promised. We wanted to thank you very much for being with us today.
Well, thank you very much, Neil.
And Chris, I wanted to thank you for the phone call. And, of course, we all know the debate that's going to matter is that public radio debate on January 6th. And I'll see you out in Ames, Iowa, okay?
Well, very good, Neil. I hope to see you there. But please do understand, the issues that are talked about here, the questions that are asked of the candidates, are the hard questions that would be asked in New York City or Los Angeles or Dallas or Nowheresville, USA. They are asked here. The war, the tax cuts, the jobs, the economy. Those are the questions. Those are the issues that are talked about. We don't just have photo ops holding little pigs here, okay?
Okay, Chris.
And thank you very much.
All right. Bye-bye. Still with us here in the studio is Ken Rudin, who's got some more buttons for our email challenge. Roosevelt 04, so what if they're dead? That one comes from Michael Lewis. And that's if you've got an email challenge, a button you'd like to see us consider for this campaign tour, TOTN@npr.org.
One of my favorite buttons of the 1962 California governor's race is a Richard Nixon button. The top half of the button is the color brown. The bottom half is the color pink, and it says IS in the middle. And obviously, if you stare at it long enough, you know the slogan, the saying is brown is pink. Governor Brown is a pinko.
I get you
classic
there.
Stuff.
Okay. What happened to I Like Ike?
Or Tina.
Let's go to, excuse me, is this Ross in hello? I think I messed up the buttons. Please excuse me. The buttons,
don't
yes. The buttons. Let's try it again. Cole is on the line with us from Gladstone, New Jersey.
How are you?
All right.
I'm a civics teacher, so my question has more to do with process than the content or the campaigns. First, Senator Harkin sort of asked this in a way. I wonder if you might go into a little bit more about regional primaries and the prospects for those. And the other question was, the other thing that will be playing out, at least starting to next year, is the way the nation does elections now. Because of Florida, Congress and the President signed into law the Help America Vote Act, which in a lot of ways opens the door to really reform elections in the nation across the board and opens, I suspect, an opportunity for a lot more involvement of young people and in greater turnout in the process. How will those efforts, in terms of fixing the process of elections, impact the way the parties run next year? And last, if George Bush wanted to, regards a button, buy up old Ford whip inflation now buttons and do something else with them.
Okay. Thanks very much, Cole.
Thanks.
Ken Rudin?
Well, as far as the regional primaries go, they have suggested this every 4 years in the last four or five cycles and just seems to never go anywhere. They tried to have a North Dakota, South Dakota primary that would follow, and not many people paid attention to that. But in the state constitution of New Hampshire, New Hampshire says it has to go first, and they made this deal with Iowa. Iowa is a caucus state, so that they have this exemption because it's not really a primary state. So it's actually the state constitution. Now, Washington, D.C. has decided that on January 13th, they're going to have a primary, too. The DNC doesn't recognize that because it says, look, it can't go before New Hampshire because of this state law. So D.C. is going to have it anyway, although it'll be a beauty contest with no delegates. My point is that everybody is so provincial and so territorial about its role in the calendar that it just one of these days we're going to have this national primary because that's where we're leading to. But until then, it doesn't seem like it's going to happen.
Let's check in now. We heard from Iowa with New Hampshire. Democratic National Committeeman Gaten Diganji joins us now from his office in Merrimack, New Hampshire. And it's good of you to be with us on Talk of the Nation.
No, it's a pleasure to be here. Good afternoon.
And going back to that question, it's obviously in the state. It's a state law that New Hampshire be the first in the nation primary. But how come? Why is it so important? And why, give Arizona a chance?
Well, a couple of things. And the first is, New Hampshire was the first state to move to allowing direct voter participation in the primary process. That's over 50 years ago. So we have an historical stay in this. The other thing is we've got a highly educated voting populace, and election after election we have the highest voter turnout in the country. So those things, and you pack that all up, we understand retail politics. We have a history of this. We have the experience in this, and this is a wonderful way for candidates to be vetted.
In New Hampshire, independents are allowed also in the primary.
Yes, they are. Yes.
And doesn't that broaden out the electorate a little bit?
Yes, it does. We expect approximately 200,000 people to come and vote in our primary on the 27th of January. And we expect about 65,000 of those are going to be independents. Now, that total in combination, that's up from 157,000 in 2000. So that tells you there's a lot of interest. There's an incredible amount of participation.
I know that all your thoughts are focused on democracy and the state of the republic, but does the infusion of all these presidential campaigns help the economy in the state of New Hampshire at all?
Well, you know, it does somewhat, but it's a bit of a misconception for people to think that that's, you know, the big tell-all, and that's why we do this. We have a racetrack here, New Hampshire International Speedway.
Mm-hmm.
We have three NASCAR races per year here now. We generate a far greater income from tourist dollar than we ever do from the presidential primaries in that respect.
Are you beginning to see a lot of activity there now? I mean, I know that a lot of candidates have been there. They just about moved in at this point.
Yes, indeed. Yes, we are. And as a matter of fact, as of yesterday, Secretary of State, we've opened our office for filing, and we've had the beginnings of folks coming in to file for president. Richard Gephardt came in and filed yesterday.
Gaetan DeGonge, thanks very much.
Thank you.
And have a great campaign season.
Thank you.
Gaetan DeGonge was on the phone with us from his office in Merrimack, New Hampshire, where he's the Democratic National Committeeman for his state. And let's get another caller on the line. Greg is with us from San Diego.
Yes, good morning. It's still morning here in beautiful San Diego. I really feel that the primary system needs to be shortened tremendously to 6 months. It turns out to be really more of an entertainment form, like a, you know, 2-year opera. Presidential election ends, and already people are looking forward 4 years. And the gentleman from New Hampshire, you know, I'm sure he's very proud of his state and the very good people there, but they really don't represent, quote unquote, the face of America.
Mm-hmm.
And for them to have the kind of a veto power as to who survives that first primary is really unfair to folks. I know primaries are coming closer together now, but even so, New Hampshire will still retain that sense of, oh, being the decisive beginning. If Dean should edge out Kerry, if Kerry should edge out Dean, the media will really hone in on that, and you know, one or the other will be crowned the leader of the pack, and you know, so that the only winner, with all due respects to this, you know, 4-year long campaign, is the mass media, because the candidates, they need money. The reason that they need money is to buy TV, radio, newspaper ads. It just needs to be shortened. The folks in Great Britain, I know they have a parliamentary type system where, you know, the prime minister.
Well, you're in California. You just had an experience with a short election.
Yes. And this was far, far too short. And
right.
There were too many uncertainties.
Ken, is there any possibility of shorter election campaigns?
I hope not. But no, I understand Greg's point, and it is exactly true. It seems like it does go on forever. But regarding his point about the veto power of New Hampshire, we have to remember that I just have a list as he was talking. I was writing down some of the Democrats who won. Gary Hart won New Hampshire, didn't get the nomination. Paul Tsongas got it. Pat Buchanan won New Hampshire. John McCain won New Hampshire. So you can't really say that New Hampshire has this veto power. Decides it's not the kingmaker state.
You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And while Democrats battle it out for their party's nomination, the Republicans, of course, get to avoid internal wear and tear, knowing that President Bush will be their nominee. Joining us now to talk about what Republicans are thinking about this year is Bill McInturff. He's a partner at Public Opinion Strategies, a GOP pollster and strategist. He's with us from his office in Alexandria, Virginia, and good to have you back on Talk of the Nation.
Well, thank you, Neil. It's good to be back.
So,
friend Ken Rudin as well.
Yeah, Bill.
What are you doing at this stage of the game, a year away from the election?
Well, the president's reelection is first raising money, and they're doing that quite successfully. And two, quietly around the country, they are putting in place their kind of state field and political operations. And then three, today we have elections in Mississippi, Kentucky, very, very important gubernatorial elections. The RNC during the Bush era has worked incredibly hard at improving its turnout operations, and that worked very well in 2002, and they continue to kind of experiment to make sure we learn more and more about how to increase Republican turnout, which is what's going on today in these states. And then when you're an incumbent president, the other thing you look at, frankly, is legislative success. And, you know, when you run for president, you want to run with a certain group of accomplishments. And so I think for the Bush administration, as an incumbent president, they're also looking at Congress. The president will sign a partial birth abortion ban, maybe not popular with NPR listeners, but I think very, very important to his reelection this week, and the energy bill and the Medicare drug bill. Whether or not those pass really are very, very important to the president's reelection. So they're also looking at congressional action and making sure that he's building a track record that they can run on to justify a second term.
You mentioned money, and the last figure I saw was upwards of $80 million that the campaign has raised so far. And one thing that everybody who hasn't raised that much money says about somebody who has is, gee, you know, maybe all that money is you know, somehow corrupting the process. Maybe it's almost a little obscene.
Well, the thing folks need to recognize is there was one very liberal donor who just wrote a $10 million check to give to an organization to work against Bush. Unfortunately, McCain-Feingold, the new campaign finance law, did not stop soft money. It just did this kind of crazy thing where it meant where parties cannot use soft money, but outside groups can. And so as you look at the Democrat candidates, these very liberal special interest groups that have been funded to defeat Bush and the labor unions, in aggregate, all of those three combined will represent a substantial chunk of money. And the Bush folks are saying, and I think they're right, the money they're raising directly is essentially the money they need to neutralize what will be an extraordinary effort by the left-to-center coalitions in this country to try to defeat the president.
Bill McInturff, thanks very much for being with us.
All right, thank you.
Bill McInturff is a Republican pollster and strategist. He was with us on the phone from his office in Alexandria, Virginia. We're talking about the election process and your concerns a year out. Our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, email TOTN@NPR.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Today we're discussing the 04 election, first Tuesday in November, 1 year from now. If you'd like to join the conversation, our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, the email address TOTN@NPR.org. We're asking for nominees for good campaign buttons, and this one from Paige Wallace, when you carry enough to choose the very best. NPR's political editor Ken Rudin is with us here in Studio 3. Even he groaned over that one. And also with us is, Michael Cornfield is with us, and he's a director of research for the Democracy Online Project. And one of the things that has been characteristic of this year's election and the last few election cycles, to tell you the truth, has been the expectation that online, that the web would begin to change things fundamentally. Are we beginning to see the beginnings of that, Michael?
Forget everything we said about 2000 being the year of the Internet, Neil. This time we really mean it. 2004 is going to be the year of the Internet.
Well, what effect has it had? We know that Howard Dean has been cited as a master online fundraiser, for example.
Well, consider that Iowa is not going first this cycle. The first primaries have already taken place. They took place in June. The MoveOn.org primary and the so-called money primary, which is raising money by the FEC deadline for the second quarter. the purpose of an early primary or an early caucus like Iowa and New Hampshire is not to win delegates, although delegates are awarded. The number of delegates is trivial. The real purpose of those early races is this is where we all hear about the candidates and who's out front. This is where you get media attention. This is where you get money. Howard Dean made the cover of Time and Newsweek and went on Larry King Live and got all that attention because of how well he did last June with the activity online. The internet has moved the starting line of the presidential nomination race back 7 months.
And how much money has Howard Dean raised on the internet?
So far he's raised, well, it's hard to say because, you know, you can hear about something and then go to the internet and the internet processes it. So that's really a trivial distinction between whether you raised it completely online or completely offline. The most important things about Howard Dean's fundraising are he's got $25 million and he's the first presidential candidate ever to get into the top tier of candidates raising most of his money from small donors, people giving under $200, and that would not be possible without the internet.
Now, is anybody else using the internet well this time around?
Well, Bush Cheney is using the internet very well. They are going to roll out an internet communications network, the likes of which you've never seen. They are using it for different purposes than Howard Dean. They're using it to send out very targeted messages, but they used it well in 2000, well after they learned from John McCain that the internet could be used, and they'll use it again very well this year.
Is the tone of a campaign on the internet different than what we've seen in the debates and the sound bites that we're accustomed to?
Well, on the internet, you can find any tone you want. You can find dignified, you can find substantive, you can find frenetic, you can find hysterical, you can find funny. So the answer is yes to all of the above. The internet is so big that you can find political discourse in whatever key and mood you want.
In addition to fundraising, are we beginning to see the internet being used as an organizational tool in some of the same ways that we've seen various demonstrators in the past few years use it as an organizational device?
Absolutely right. And one of the innovations of this year is that the internet is being used in combination with physical meetings, both through an organization known as meetup.com and through local meetings organized on the internet. This is a way, cost-effective way of bringing people together so that they can feed on each other's enthusiasm and then go back and do the things that need to be done to win an election.
So when you go back and write the history of the internet and politics, you're going to skip all those other ones. You're going to start in this election.
Well, no, actually my book is coming out in December and I had to pull it out to write a preface about Howard Dean, but maybe the second edition.
Michael Kornfield, thanks very much for joining us today. Michael Kornfield is Director of Research for the Democracy Online Project, and he joined us here in Studio 3A. Ken Rudin, we've got a couple of minutes left to talk about some congressional races that are coming up, the broad outlines of the races to control the House of Representatives and the United States Senate. In the Senate, the third of the electorate is up. Of course, everybody is up in the House as they are every 2 years. The Republicans control both houses now. The Democrats are hoping to recover. Any chance of that?
Well, the Democrats have been taking several body blows as of late because four prominent Democrats from the South, Democratic incumbents, have all announced their retirement. Yesterday was Bob Graham of Florida. Before that, it was Zell Miller, Georgia, John Edwards of North Carolina, Fritz Hollings of South Carolina. There's also a possibility that John Brough of Louisiana may not run again. And obviously, the South is President Bush's strongest place in the country. Al Gore did not carry a single state in the South. There's bad news for the Democrats if they want to recapture the Senate. Now, in fairness to the Democrats, there are also two Republicans retiring, Peter Fitzgerald in Illinois, who was weak anyway, and the Democrats have a very good shot at winning that. They could also win the seat of Lisa Murkowski in Alaska. She was appointed by her father, who left to become governor, then appointed her to succeed him in the Senate.
The bigger majority for the Republicans in the House and redistricting in Texas is going to have a big effect on that.
That's right. We'll see the effects already. A lot of Democrats are running scared. They're running in districts they're not familiar with or comfortable with. On March 2nd, Texas has its primary, and we'll see. It's very possible that the Republicans could pick up anywhere between 5 and 8 new seats in Congress from Texas alone.
Let's get a caller on the line, and Doug joins us on the line from Pennsylvania.
Yeah, hi, guys. I have a campaign slogan, greed or green, it's your choice.
And I'm
the chair of the Pennsylvania Green Party, and we're promoting this notion that by default or design, the Green Party is going to have a tremendous impact on the next election.
In presidential races or congressional races or where?
Well, congressional races, because we'll be running a number of candidates, but I think in terms of the presidential election, we're going to, with our small percentage, be able to swing one direction or the next, and we'll have to see what happens. I think we can have a tremendous impact in that regard.
Ken Rudin, the Greens certainly had an impact last time.
I was just going to say that Al Gore people to this day still say that the reason Gore lost the presidency was because of the appearance on the ballot of Green Party nominee Ralph Nader. I also noticed that, speaking of Iowa, as we were earlier, Green Party caucuses, for the first time, Green Party will be having their own caucuses, and I believe that's the first time in Green Party history.
Well, Doug,
absolutely, and we have a convention coming up in July in which we're going to nominate a presidential candidate, a number of congressional candidates, of course, as well, and the notion of swinging the election, I think, is something that's not incumbent on the Democrats to blame us. It happens to be the fact that people don't support either party.
Okay, Doug, thanks very much for the call, and good luck
to you. Thanks a lot.
Okay. Ken Rudin, as we look ahead, he was just talking about his convention, one of the little recognized perks of controlling the White House is you get to have your convention last. How important is that?
Well, it is important. It is very important in the sense that, obviously, whatever bounce the Democrats will get out of their convention, and we assume there will be a bounce, the incumbent party goes second. Remember, I always think of 1988 in Atlanta when Michael Dukakis came out of the Democratic convention with a 17-point lead over then-Vice President George Bush, but then the Republican convention came, and Michael Dukakis has not been heard from since.
Ken Rudin, thanks very much for being with us today. We appreciate
it.
Ken Rudin, NPR's political editor, was with us here in 3A, and our apologies to Michael Kornfield. We misidentified his organization. He is with the Institute for Politics, Democracy, and the Internet, and we thank him for that correction. And we have one final entry in our campaign button email challenge, this one from Mac Lake, and it's from Mesa, Arizona. His suggestion is, it's the war, stupid. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.